Hello, everyone. Welcome in live nationwide and around the world to Ron Zedgy Today. And I'm a little concerned about this week's show because it's so big, I hope we can get it into your radio or computer. My goodness. My first guest, my old friend Lee Greenwood, will be joining us. One of the hardest working men on TV, Al Roker, will be here. Talk show host and author Glenn Beck has a new book out. It's called Liars. He'll be joining us. Great volleyball champ and host of TV Strong, Gabrielle Reese. Then later on, Charlie Daniels will be joining us on the show. Actor Pablo Schreiber. Author Chuck Pora has a book called Peace to You Too, Brother, about the Vietnam era. And documentary movie producer Patrick Creedon. And it's all coming up live all across the USA and around the world. This week with Ron Zedgy Today, we're going to pause. We'll be right back with my first guest, Lee Greenwood.
And I gladly stand up next to you and defend her still today. Cause there ain't no doubt I love this land.
And we are back live all across the USA and around the world. It's Ron Zedgy Today. And that is the voice of a friend of mine for a long, long time, Lee Greenwood. Hi, Lee. How you doing?
Ron, great to talk to you again. The last time I think I visited with you was at your studio in your house.
Right.
And it's great to talk to you again. I hope everything's good with you.
Absolutely. And I want to congratulate you because I just found out that you have become America's ambassador to the disabled American veterans. There are a lot of people in business and several in the entertainment business that certainly respond to the call of our veterans. But Lee is one of the top three. And congratulations on that. I don't even know who the other two are, you know, to be honest with you.
Well, I don't either, but I know that Tony Orlando and Gary Sinise and I are all American patriots that actually stand up whenever we're asked. And we are actually trustees for the Medal of Honor Society, and we're building them a new museum in Charleston, South Carolina, to be completed in the next two or three years. But as far as being an ambassador for DAV, a lot of people may not recognize what DAV is or stands for. There is PVA, which is Paralyzed Veterans of America. There's the American Legion. There's the Veterans of Foreign Wars, VFW, and then DAV, Disabled American Veterans. These are all wounded veterans physically who have been on the march to protect the other veterans who may fall by the wayside, the homeless, the drug addicts, the alcoholics, the divorcees, the depressed, the PSDTC, and all of the things that might affect a veteran to stop them from committing suicide. These 22 suicides a day are the worst tragedy we could have for a military veteran who has served this country.
You know, I couldn't agree with you more. You know, I just lost a brother a couple of weeks ago, and we used to talk on the telephone all the time about the commercials that run about different organizations that help the veterans. And we just couldn't understand why the United States of America wouldn't and hasn't and so and don't really protect the most important resource we have, children and veterans. I mean, if there were no veterans, there'd be no yesterday, today, or tomorrow for children. I just don't understand why that isn't the first priority of any administration.
Yeah, well, I think most of it is about the internet. It's about people moving on to what's the next news. It would really help if we had a president and an administration that would actually embrace it more,
right,
and make it more obvious. I mean, that's one of the reasons I've jumped in to be an ambassador for the DAV, to raise awareness of their mission and their goal. And for the next year, you'll see advertisements, me visiting veterans hospitals across the country. On TV and radio, you'll hear spots about honoring the DAV and what it does. And hopefully that awareness will bring more donations, more funds, and take care of more soldiers.
Lee, anything we can do, you know we're in. Because, you know, all the PSAs, anytime you want to come on and talk about it, if you need an MC for a show you're doing, I'll do anything to hop on board this because it is so important. Those suicides every day by people who protect us, and a lot of people I see protesting and everything else has no clue why they have the right to do that, is absolutely one of the most embarrassing things that this country has, not taking care of these people that you're going to be addressing.
Yeah, it bothers me. And Ron, you've always been an advocate for the military. I will draw upon you when the time comes.
The fact is, all this work that Lee does and going to be doing as the ambassador for the disabled American veterans is on top of a very active tour, which started on August 7th and goes all the way through February 25th in Weirsdale, Florida. You and I talked the last time. I don't know how you do this. You told me you were looking at slowing down. This doesn't look like a list of dates of a person slowing down.
Yeah, I think what it is now is that I pick and choose the dates I want instead of the dates that are always thrown at me. And I've always been a worker since I was 12 years old, and that's just kind of what I do. I don't know what I would do if I just slow down, sit around the pool, and occasionally get a phone call. I just have a nature that I want to work. And my 18-year-old the other day, I must admit, we went to Scandinavia for 2 weeks with my family, my two boys, my wife and I. And the international travel, of course, takes it out of you for about 2 or 3 days, keeps your feet on the ground again. But I wasn't home but 2 hours, and I went out with four more flights to different cities before I got back home. And my son said, I don't know how you do it. And I said, well, to tell you the truth, I am a little air weary, but I'm kind of like the Energizer Buddy. Give me about a week and I'll be fine.
In addition to being a great singer, songwriter, and guitar player, Lee is also a tremendous sax player. I mean, when you were here last time, you did the instrumental version of God Bless the USA on a very unique sax, I might add.
Yes. That's my soprano sax, and of course I play all of them. When I fly, I generally don't fly the soprano, but if I do in my Christmas shows, you will always see me play that one.
Lee, one of Billboard's 100 greatest country artists of all time. He's had so many big awards, CMA, ACM Awards, Grammy Awards, Top Male Vocalist. Also had something like 7, 8 number one hits, 38 singles, including songs like It Turns Me Inside Out. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And, of course, penned the song God Bless the USA, which, you know, I still think should be our national anthem.
Well, I'm proud of all of our history. Our discography stretches back to 1980, and we began releasing music. But in those days, it was considered the real country, the real mellow country that a lot of people swung over to when they were tired of rock and pop. But of course now all kinds of formats have blended together, and country music today is pretty quick. You won't see or hear too many ballads anymore.
No.
So during that time of those romantic songs that I released, and there was probably 10 or 12 of those, most of them were very popular with people who first became country fans and then became a fan of us. So I'm grateful for all that.
And also honored with the Congressional Medal of Honor. When you were here, the children's book was just in its infancy. In fact, it was going to be released like in 30 days, okay? And you gave me a copy of it, but not the final copy. I went out and got a final copy. I have two grandchildren, one little boy and a little girl. The little boy is 3 years old. He loves that book. I've been wanting to tell you that for the past 6 months.
Well, thank you.
He loves that book, and it's called Proud to Be an American.
It's a children's illustrated book, and it was so penned and so drawn so that we would actually interest children of that age. And where else would you get a better idea of patriotism than through a book when kids are first experiencing books and the fantasy world that they get from reading it and learning how to read? So it's great for grandparents and parents alike to teach their kids a little bit of patriotism through our book.
And by the way, it's available in stores and on Amazon called Proud to Be an American. You did a great job with it.
Well, thank you. Yeah, education is a tough thing. You know, it has to educate the masses. And I understand the procedure of America and its education. We have two boys. One's a senior in high school and one's a senior in college. And their education from the very beginning came from us reading to them.
Sure.
So if your parents are listening to this broadcast, read to your kids early. Start just before they're a year old and read till they read to you. And once they get reading to you, then they're on their own. But that early reading makes them understand so many things, not just colors and numbers, animals, geography, but also lessons of patriotism, respect, perseverance. And so you'll get that from early reading before they get into novels and then basically something they really personally like.
When you talk about how old your boys are, I shudder because I remember when they were born. Unbelievable. Now, again, the Disabled American Veterans campaigns, including Keep the Promise, Thank a Vet. The bottom line is there's a whole bunch of tour dates, and you can find out where Lee is going to be playing between now and the first quarter of next year on LeeGreenwood.com, and you can follow him on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. He's one of those knowledgeable guys on the web. And I must again repeat that if you want to get involved, the website to go to is www.dav.org. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Lee, like I said, I could talk to you for hours. I really am so glad that you're here. I'm so glad that you're now the ambassador for the Disabled American Veterans. Thank you for your service to not only the music business, but to the business of veterans. And that's a huge, huge accomplishment to be able to be in that position and steer that kind of hope and help to our veterans that you're doing as the ambassador. Good work, Lee.
Well, thank you. We'll have some more up-and-coming news that I'd like to talk to you about within about a month. A Lee Greenwood collection of home goods is being broken. We did that in Atlanta at the Mart recently, and that national news will break shortly. We can talk again about that. In the meantime, watch for our ads with DAV and go to my website to see what we're doing. It's a newly designed website, leegreenwood.com.
That sounds great. And I will tell you this, I still get a standing ovation by doing God Bless the USA as the last song. What a great way to get a standing ovation for a guy that doesn't deserve one is when I do that song.
Yeah, you do deserve it too, Ron. You're a wonderful guy.
Okay. Lee, thank you so much. Tell Kim I said hello, okay?
God bless. Thank
okay,
you, Ron.
You too. One of my favorite people, one of the nicest guys you will ever find, not only in the entertainment business, but just, you know, an everyday guy, Lee Greenwood, the new ambassador for the Disabled American Veterans. And check out his website, leegreenwood.com. And there's more to come with Ron Sedgie today. And our next guest hasn't been with us in a long time, but I must admit, he's one of my favorite guys to talk to on the show. A hard-working broadcaster, there is no doubt about it. It's always a delight having him. And of course, the main question that we always get from our associates here at the studio when we know that Al's going to be on is, what time do you get up in the morning? Joining us right now is Big Al Roker. Hello, Al. How you doing, my friend?
Hey, well, I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing good. So what is the time?
I get up between 3 and 3:15. That's about par for the course. So on the weekends, I may actually sleep in till 7.
Oh, really? Oh my goodness gracious! You're really slacking on the weekends. Aren't
you? I know.
What time do you go to bed, Al?
You know what? I've got my middle girl is now in 7th grade. So I'm hard pressed to try to go to sleep before she does.
Uh-huh.
So I usually get to bed around 10:15.
That's an old saying with hardest working person in show business. You really earn every dime you make. I tell you, you are something else.
Well, I appreciate that. But you know, I've got a terrific job. I work with amazing people. I'm nicely compensated for it. You know, there are a lot of folks who work a lot harder under much more trying conditions, who don't, you know, do nearly as well. So, you know what? I'm very blessed.
And you're appreciative, too. That's what makes Al what he is, an all-around nice guy. And in addition to his duties and weather and co-hosting the Today Show, he also has Al Roker Entertainment, which, by the way, has started with a new 10 half-hour episodes of a show called Big Easy Justice, Tuesdays on Spike TV. And this is about Tattoo, which, can I mention the guy's name?
Sure, yeah. Yep.
Gene Thacker is the name. He's a bounty hunter. By the way, I just found this out, Al. The real term for bounty hunter is bail enforcement agent. I never knew that. But tell us about the Big Easy Justice. I saw it last week. It's a great show.
Well, thank you. It's one of these things, and it's funny. Somebody from Jennifer Lopez's production company saw this guy on local TV in New Orleans and took it to Spike TV, and they said, "Well, we love this character, but you guys have never done anything like this. We'd like to team you up with Al Roker's company because they've done these kind of shows before." And so it's been a great partnership. And you know, Gene Thacker, otherwise known as Tattoo, is the baddest of the tough guys when it comes to bounty hunters. When I met him, he's this very soft-spoken guy, barely looks you in the eye. I thought, this can't be a bounty hunter. Then I went out with him, and I thought, oh, my gosh, you know, this guy is unbelievable. You know, when the sun goes down, you know, he gets his bat on, and he goes after these folks. This is not your typical, you know, the New Orleans we all see, you know, the Bourbon Street and the French Quarter. This is the grittier, tougher part of New Orleans where a lot of folks, you know, the bad guys and women are hanging out. And, you know, he loves the city. He grew up in the city and is trying to make it better one apprehended felon at a time.
Now, I saw a statistic that blew me away. In a 12-year bounty career, he brought in 1,000 fugitives. Now, I put the pencil and paper to that. That's like every day.
Yeah, they go out, say, after 10 o'clock at night, and they are out there till, you know, 5, 6 in the morning, you know, going after these folks. They can't find one person, they go after another. Mm-hmm. But they always come back around. They always get their man or woman.
Do they normally do it at night, Al?
Yeah, generally speaking, they can do it during the day, but they just find nighttime is a better time because people are, you know, a little more relaxed. They've dropped their guard. It makes it easier to go after these folks.
And I think it's important to note here that the show Big Easy Justice, we're talking about, produced by Al Roker Entertainment, these bounty hunters, and in particular Tattoo, which is Gene Thacker. He goes after armed robbers, murderers,
yep.
drug
yep.
possession, domestic abuse, domestic violence. I mean, there is no limit. I mean, he's not saying, well, you know, we're just getting somebody who had their library book overdue.
Right. No, these are bad people, and that's why, I mean, they've got full body armor. Our crews that are going out have full body armor on. And, you know, I mean, they got to deal with this stuff because you don't know what's around the corner or behind that door. And you got to be prepared.
How do you do this, Al? I'm always intrigued by these shows that go after the bad guys because of the fact that they show these people sometimes on the air. How do you get clearances for that, if I may?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We have to get releases from people, and you would be surprised at how many people will sign a release.
Yeah. And what? And get out of show business?
Yeah. I mean, it's really funny. I think there's some perverse pleasure. Okay, I'm going to jail, but you know what? At least I'm going to get my, you know, my 5 minutes of fame.
Yeah, that's what always amazed me. You know, this guy gets picked up for, you know, raping and murdering, and he's on camera, and, you know, he's smiling because he thinks he's the next, you know, Dean Martin.
Exactly. So, you know, it's, I'm always kind of intrigued by it. God bless.
Yeah.
Thank goodness, or else we have to blur their faces.
I think I should have a disclaimer saying that Dean Martin did none of these things that we just talked about.
No, he did. No.
It was just a reference to
none of them.
Just a reference to popularity is all it was. Now, does he ever fear, obviously, for his life day in and day out? Because, first of all, somebody breaks bail, they're not what you call a good person anyway. So is he ever concerned, being the tough guy that he is, that he might be in harm's way?
Well, you know, that's what, you know, he says, when you let your guard down, that's when you get in trouble. So they are vigilant. They're always concerned. You know, the motto kind of is everybody goes home. It's interesting too because he's got kind of this street code. As long as you respect him, he respects you.
Mm-hmm.
You don't show him respect, he's coming out. He's going to drop on you like a ton of bricks.
Yeah. Now, after the 10 half-hour episodes are up, Al, do you think you go back and do another 10 or 15?
Well, we're hoping for the same success with this as we have right now on the Weather Channel with Coast Guard Alaska.
Oh,
which,
I love that show.
With Wednesday nights at 9 Eastern. We just started our second season with that, and we're now doing a spinoff, Coast Guard Florida, where we're going to be based in Clearwater, but also Miami and Key West.
Geez, if you come down and do that, let me know. I'll go out on a boat with you.
Absolutely.
You need a dose of Ron every other day.
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know if we can handle that.
I don't know, but it's worth a try, isn't it?
I know.
When Al Roker Entertainment puts their name on it, you know it's good, and that's what has happened in this particular case. Al, as always, you know you're welcome here anytime, and I can't wait till you come down again and see you. And I might be up in New York with Jimmy Fallon, so when I do that, I'm going to stop.
Oh, my gosh,
him.
Please let me know. Yeah, we love Jimmy. I mean, he's really developed into just such a terrific late-night host. I mean, he really has.
Well, Al, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you, Ron.
Always great chatting with you.
Take care.
You too. Al Roker's been our guest, and one of the, if not the hardest-working man on television.
Thanks so much, Ron.
You're welcome, Al. Al Roker is not only a hard-working broadcaster, but one lucky man. Anybody that goes to work and works alongside of Natalie Morales, that co-anchor on the show, is one lucky guy. I'm delighted to have our next guest with us. We haven't had him on, and I'm glad he's here right now. He and I do the same thing, nationally syndicated radio host, founder of the Blaze Television Network, and 13 times number one best-selling author. He's got the book that's in front of me right now called Liars, How Progressives Exploit Our Fears for Power and Control. Isn't that the truth? Joining us right now is Glenn Beck. Hi, Glenn. How you doing, my friend?
Hi, Ron. Very good. Thank you so much. It's an honor to be on your show.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate that, and I feel the same way about having you here, so that's terrific.
Thank you.
You know, I read the book. Every page is the truth. I mean, fear is a political tactic that has been used for years and years and years. I couldn't help recalling that in the 1928 campaign for president, Herbert Hoover said a chicken in every pot and a car in every garage, and then a year later, we had the stock market crash.
Yep.
What, for those people who may not know, explain to them what progressives are, Glenn.
Progressives, early 20th century American progressive, which is exactly word for word the way Hillary Clinton describes herself. She makes a point of saying, I am an early 20th century American progressive. They were socialists. They were also fascists. But this is before communism, socialism, or fascism had bad names. So this is early, this is before World War II. And they were fans of the great state. They were fans of Mussolini. They were fans of Stalin. Woodrow Wilson wrote love letters about how great Stalin was.
Right.
Time magazine wrote love letters about Mussolini. What they believed is the Constitution was an old dusty document that no longer had any relevance in America because the state and the elites and science would lead us into the new bold century. They just didn't want to have the revolution. So the reason why they're called progressives is because they would progress to that all-controlling state a little piece at a time because they knew Americans would never go for a revolution, and they didn't want one. But they are unbelievably dangerous because they believe wholeheartedly, and they are willing to do whatever they have to do because people are replaceable. It is the elite that understands the collective, and the collective future is what's important. So that's where you get Planned Parenthood and Margaret Sanger wanting to kill all the blacks in America, wanting to kill anyone who she deemed inferior in America. It was the progressive movement in America, and we have the documentation to back it up. It was actually the Human Betterment Association in California that was credited by the Nazis in 1936 for showing them how to use eugenics and how to be able to get rid of all of the inferiors. And it says in this letter from the Nazis, I never want you to forget, I hope you remember until the day you die, that your visit over to us has excited a nation of 60 million into this new field. And that's who they are. They believe that they are the ranchers and people are cattle.
You mentioned Wilson, and in the book, he's a pretty prominent character in the book here.
I hate him. I hate him.
But you know, Glenn, was he the first president in the 20th century, and of course there weren't many before him, that really became progressive?
Oh, no, no, no. It was Theodore Roosevelt who started the Progressive Party. Yeah, and he is the first guy that started, you know, the administrative state. He started the FDA, which was started on a lie. He started the FDA on Coca-Cola getting rid of cocaine in Coca-Cola.
Mm-hmm.
And Coca-Cola said, we haven't had cocaine in it for, you know, decades. It doesn't have any cocaine. It didn't matter to him. Even during the trial, when the scientists came out and said, Your Honor, there's no cocaine in it, and here's the evidence. It actually went to trial. The government lost the case, but said, well, we need the FAA because of products that, you know, Coca-Cola could have been like. It doesn't matter what lies they have to tell to be able to get the big state. And that came from Woodrow Wilson. And there's a reason why now in Common Core, you don't learn American history prior to 1880. And that's because, as you find out in the book very clearly, 1880 is a turning point for the progressive movement. It comes from Nietzsche and nihilism and the nastiness of Germany. We go over to Germany. Wilson is one of them that goes over and studies in Germany and brings it back around 1880. And that is the new founding of our country.
Now, you say that the book's goal is knowing the roots of progressive impulse, seeing it for what it is, and freeing yourself from it. Now, whether Democrat or Republican, there's progressive all over the place. This is that utopia society that we all yearn to have and that we are promised by these politicians. How do we free ourselves from it? If somebody doesn't stand in front of you and say, look, Glenn, I'm going to give you a new Lincoln and a brand new home, and life's going to be good. How do they say, I don't believe that,
well,
and where do I go?
Think, I think it's really easy once you know the truth and you're willing to admit the truth. Remember, progressivism is to take away man's choice.
Right.
Well, God didn't do that. That was Satan's idea. I'll return all your children home. Give me the glory, and I will return everybody home, but I won't give them a choice to choose. Progressives, you know, especially with Saul Alinsky, which we talk about in the book, he dedicated his movement and his book to Lucifer. He was a rebel, and he won his own kingdom. So I believe that progressivism, at its root, evil. We don't make this case necessarily in the book, but I believe that it is. And so if Satan, he'll offer you anything. He'll be a guy who will say, I'll give you the world. He said it to Jesus.
Yeah.
I'll give you everything. But Jesus knew, and we know who Satan is. I can't say it's easy, but it is a lot easier once you know who he is and what his desire really is. And that is total control of you and your life and soul. That's really what the progressives are offering, total control.
You describe progressives as racist, terrorists, tyrants, but what's the alternative? Now, I know it's bad. Okay, I mean, progressive movement is bad news. I don't like that fear factor that goes into it. But what is the alternative? We know the problem. What's the solution, Glenn?
The solution is truly so easy. De Tocqueville said that America is great because America is good. He couldn't figure out the reason it was good and where our strength came from until he started traveling the country in the 1800s. When he did, he realized that the pulpits were on fire and the pulpits were teaching the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence and Liberty. Every word of the Declaration of Independence came from a sermon that had been preached in the last 20 years before 1776. It was the pulpit that showed the way to liberty. They were on fire. But I will tell you, our pulpits don't even have a spark in them for most of them. So it is connecting with God and his eternal truths that man should rule himself, that man is independent. When you understand the truth, and then you look at the Constitution, and I believe that is a sacred American scripture, that is the solution. It disturbs me that most people are saying, yeah, well, Glenn, a prayer and love, that's not going to work. Well, it worked for Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm.
It sure worked for Gandhi. It sure worked for Jesus. It's why Jesus was betrayed by Judas, because Judas said, no, we want a king. You're not the Messiah. You're supposed to be a king. You're supposed to take the government over. No. When we say, well, I've got to do something, do the right thing, don't compromise out of the Constitution. We beat the British against all odds as farmers against the greatest army and navy in the world because our founders knew if we were people of merit, God would come to our side. Until we turn to God, until we become a slave to him, we will be a slave to man.
I could talk to you for hours. Really.
I would love to be on again anytime.
And I think more people need to know about what they're being victimized to.
I would love to come back anytime. You just let us know, and I'll go a step further. If you're ever in Dallas, I have radio studios you can broadcast your show out of, and you can spend the day, and we can really get to know each other, and you can broadcast, and it's easy for me to walk down the hall to one of our radio studios and spend lots of time with you. So you just let us know.
And I'm going to reciprocate that. Whenever you're in the Orlando area where we originate our show, I'd love to have you come over and be my guest, okay?
Thank you so much. God bless.
Thanks, Glenn. I appreciate it.
You
and
bet.
Again, the name of the book is Liars, How Progressives Exploit Our Fears for Power and Control, written by our friend Glenn Beck.
Thanks, Ron. God bless you. Thank you so much.
A new show that's coming up on NBC Thursdays at 8 o'clock, and it's got quite a cast behind it. It's called Strong. Joining us right now is its host, Gabrielle Reese. Hi, Gabby. How are you?
I'm good. It's me, myself, and I hosting.
Boy, you are it. I want to tell you something. But you know what? You're the perfect person for this because a renowned athlete, best-selling author, you've hosted so many things on TV, the Fit TV, Discovery, the Gravity Games on NBC. So you are a natural at that, aside from the fact that you are probably the best volleyball player in the whole wide world. So who else to do it other than Gabby?
Well, I appreciate that compliment. I'll give you the list of other volleyball players that probably are much higher on that list than myself. But
No, we're going to go with you.
I think, you know, listen, this is a space I've lived in for a really long time. But also, the other side of that is I have a family, I have children, and so I really can relate to these women as well. So I think that, and you can, I want you to say all that stuff to my boss later, that was also important to them, is to have somebody who's there who can understand kind of both sides of what's going on.
I couldn't agree with you more. Nothing is more depressing than when you turn on a late night TV infomercial and they got this man or a woman who looks like they were just carved out of marble and says, you can look like this too. Yeah, right. Give me a break. You know, I mean, you need a regular person, and you're that. This is a huge show from the standpoint of executive producers. David Broom from The Biggest Loser,
yep.
Sylvester Stallone, Kevin Templeton, Creed, Holly Wolford from the American Ninja Warriors. But is it 10 women from all walks of life being trained, if I understand this right, by 10 men?
Yeah, so you have to remember that the other element of this show is it is truly a competition show. So not only is this trainer, who in this case the group of trainers is male because the trainees are female, not only is he mentoring her and training her and putting her through a regimen and teaching her about better, you know, food choices or, you know, just ways to do it, mental attitudes, encouragement, he's also competing alongside his trainee. So in order this round to make it as fair as possible, since all the trainees are women, all of these trainers are male because they are competing head-to-head with the other teams.
Okay, I understand that. And there's a huge, I mean, huge prize at the end of this of about $500,000, right?
Yeah, so the team that wins has the opportunity to win up to $500,000.
Wow. Now, it's 10 episodes, and each episode, the two-person team train together, they compete, but then you dwindle it down by one team every single episode?
That's right. And there's, like all good shows, there's some twists and turns, and it's very fast-paced, this show, especially in the beginning. You know, there's so many characters. It's moving along. You have these epic challenges. And I think that's another thing that's going to genuinely surprise people is you're going to see these supposedly everyday women, even though for me they became superwomen watching them do this, take on kind of these daunting challenges that they go for it, and each one is saying, hey, I'm there because I'm just trying to be the best me I can be. But at the end, do they, you know, make body transformations and lose weight? Absolutely, every single one of them. But coming into it, their tone is, hey, I just need to get as healthy as I possibly can. And there's a lot going on in the show. There's the competitive element. There's the challenges. There's the human story between the trainer and the trainee. There's her going through this kind of very difficult metamorphosis. So there's a lot to this show.
I assume, Gabby, this is not just about losing weight, but rather finding a balance between mind and body and getting strong. How old are the contestants, may I ask? Is that not ethical to ask that question?
No, of course. I mean, this is the great thing, is it's a diverse group. You have women in their early 20s who, in fact, they haven't kind of been slogged over the coals of having a family and trying to calibrate work and all of that. They're actually there saying, I'm trying to discover who I am and my voice. And then you have this whole other group, maybe in their early 30s, mid-30s, and even late 30s, saying, well, I am looking up now after 10 years of living and saying I've got to hit the reset button. And then you have some trainers that are certainly in their late 20s, all the way through their 30s, and then we have some trainers in their 40s. So you have a good array of age group.
I was waiting for you to hit my age group. Should I wait a little bit longer?
Hey, listen, you and me both, and this is what I want to say. You know, I joke, my husband's best friend is 83, and this guy, on my best day, I would never even see his backside on a bike ride. And
really?
He goes helicopter snowboarding. So I think the other thing is that reminder of my best self wherever I am in this life. And yeah. And it doesn't matter if we're 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, that opportunity to be better each day is there for all of us. Doesn't mean we're not dealing with aches and pains and this and that, but there is a way that each day you could improve. And this show really shows you that.
Am I being too cavalier if I ask what some of the challenges are, or are we going to save that for the viewers to be surprised with?
It would be hard to title them, but for example, one of my favorites was this giant sort of two-story spinning wheel that had handles on it that they'd have to stay up and basically using just their arms, and it would change and shift speeds. You have certain challenges where if the team doesn't work together as a team, meaning like doing a press up, you know, with this cylinder filled with liquid, at the same exact time, they don't get credit. There's so many different challenges. I mean, obviously the most steadfast one in the whole thing is the Elimination Tower, which is there every single week. The challenges through the week change, but the Elimination Tower, for the most part, stays the same, and that's a four-story, you know, monolith that is meant to really challenge every part of their body, and it's also the place that gets decided who goes home. Because at the end of the day, whoever was slower, it's that straightforward, they're the ones that will go home.
Have you had the opportunity to try a couple of these things out?
A lot of people have asked me that, and the truth is they don't let me get near it. I mean, you know, there's so much stuff going on. It's quite a busy show, and so the playtime hasn't really, we haven't scheduled that. But I'm thinking in the next seasons, once we find our rhythm, there'll be some playing going on.
I think that's fantastic. I really Now, will somebody like Stallone make an appearance, or maybe Templeton make an appearance, just to spice it up a little bit?
You don't need any spicing up in this, but Sly on this round will not be in the show because there's so much to accomplish in each show that they don't add anything extra because, again, there's a lot getting done in each show, and these people are busy. They can't phone it in. They really have to deliver, and it's very quick pace.
I'm very excited about this. It's called Strong on NBC, and its host is fitness guru, our friend Gabrielle Reese. We call her Gabby around here. And I can't wait to see the show. I hope it does very, very well for you, dear.
Well, thank you. And I hope so, too. And
I can't wait till you come back and we talk about show 100.
And then I can tell you how many challenges that I've been on by then. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Gabby.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Fitness guru, great volleyball player. She's done so many things in the athletic department, and now she's hosting Strong on NBC.
Thank you, Ron.
And over the years, we've made a lot of friends, but this friend is special. And he's got a lot of big news that's going to be happening down the road here in the next 30 to 60 days. Joining us right now, our pal, Charlie Daniels. Hey, Charlie, how you doing?
Ron, it's good to be back with you, buddy. Thanks for having me on today.
Well, it's always good having you here. And you know what? I'm so excited about what's happening to you. You know, last time I think you and I talked, we were talking about a Christmas CD that you had. And then before that, it was the Bob Dylan CD. But now, coming up on the 13th of September, there's a big event that's going to be hosted. It's the annual dinner at the Palm Restaurant in Nashville of the Journey Home Project, and this is a brainchild of yours that helps veterans. Tell us about that before we get into all the other things that you're doing.
We started the Journey Home Project. We have always tried to help our veterans and our service people out, and we found that we were better served to do it, to start our own foundation, make sure where all our money went, keep up with it on a good basis, and have a auspices to raise money under. So we've been doing this now for several years, and it's a gratifying thing to do. Our veterans they're not taken care of like they should be, and there's an awful lot of loose ends tied up to help our veterans transition from serving in service to coming back home. So we try to help out when we can. We've done all kinds of things. We've helped veterans get educations. We've even helped some buy furniture. We've done all kinds of things for our best, just whatever we can do to make the transition easier. So that's what the Journey Home Foundation is all about. It's all about helping veterans.
You know, I always say that the two resources that we have in this country that can never be slighted of anything they want are children and veterans, because if it weren't for the veterans, children wouldn't have yesterday's, today's, and tomorrow's. So what you're doing is sensational. It really is. I give you a lot of credit for it.
Thank you, and you're so right about that. I'm with you 100%. That's two of my favorite things to do is for children and veterans, absolutely.
That's it. Now, this year, 2016, a lot of things are happening. For example, earlier in the year, the announcement was made that you'd be in the Country Music Hall of Fame's class of 2016, along with Randy Travis. Then the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum will have a Country Music Hall inductee exhibit of you called the Million Miles that's going to be opening on September 23rd, running through March of next year, featuring instruments, clothing, different types of sheet music, awards, childhood mementos, photographs. I think this is great, Charlie. Did you have a hand in doing this? Because I know one time I spoke to Crystal Gale, and she didn't know anything that was going to go in there.
Well, actually, I know a lot of the stuff that's going to be in there. We had a museum in downtown Nashville, and the folks who ran it lost the lease on it because somebody opened a bar there or something, so they lost the lease, and we had all of our stuff that we had in the museum. We had it all stored in one place, and it was kind of fortunate because when the Country Music Hall of Fame folks got ready to do this, they could come out, and just most of the things that we had were in one place. But they also came to my house, and they took pictures off the wall and album covers and some of my personal effects and things that that they think people have an interest in seeing. So I know a lot of the stuff is going to be there, but as to how it's going to be fixed, you know, it's one of the most interesting things I found out with the other museum we were involved in, to see somebody else's concept of your life, that they take the artifacts of your life and arrange them in the way that they see them. And the folks at the Country Music Hall of Fame are professionals, and they do a good job. So I am just as interested in seeing this as anybody else is. I'd be interested how they see my life.
You know, that's a very interesting point. My studio here has a lot of pictures of celebrities, mementos and stuff. And when people come into it, they'll say to me, boy, this is really interesting. And to me, I don't think it is. And then something that I think is interesting or unique, they don't even look at.
Yeah,
you bring up
yeah.
a very valid point. What other people perceive of your career. That's
right.
Very enlightening.
I found that out when they did the other museum. I knew the stuff, a lot of the stuff they were going to put in there, but I had no idea how they were going to arrange it. And to actually walk in and see how somebody else has took the pieces of your life, the things that mean something in your life, and just put them together the way that they see them, it's a pretty interesting thing.
Big year this year, the 13th of the next month, the Big Journey Home Project annual dinner. Then we're talking about just now the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum exhibit that's going to be opening on the 23rd of September through March of next year. Now, we got more things coming here, ladies and gentlemen. On October 28th, my friend Charlie Daniels is going to turn the big 8-0. Now, I got to tell you something, Charlie. I know people that are 80 years old, and they don't have the energy, the perseverance, the talent, and the excitement that you have, my friend.
Well, you're very kind. It's kind of snuck up on me. It's like birthdays are just that way. You don't really think about them later there. And sometimes it's hard for me to realize that 80 years of my life have gone by. When the thing is, everybody says time rushes by, and it really does. But then if you want to kind of slow it down a little bit, if you'll take and sit and pull all the pieces out, expect them one at a time, just stop and think about all your experiences, all the things you've done, all the places you've been, all the people that you've met, the people you've seen, the situations you've been involved in, it kind of makes you realize, hey, yeah, I have been around a long time. And I'm writing a biography that I've been involved in for quite a few years to get it done, and I get a chance to do a lot of reminiscing. Because of that, I get a chance to recall a lot of things that happened a long time ago and kind of dredge them back up and enjoy the memories all over again. So if you're getting old and you think time's gone by in a hurry, stop and start pulling those memories out one at a time and examining them, and you'd be surprised how time has not gone by nearly as fast as you think it has.
Is it therapeutic doing that, a biography?
I think it is. You know, my problem was always trying to find a stopping place or a pausing place. And one of the reasons being is because my career goes on. I'm not intending to retire. I have no plans to retire. So where do you stop? Where do you cut it off? Where do you, something memorable may happen. You know, like if I had cut this off a couple of years ago, I would not have, a few years ago, I would not even have the Grand Ole Opry invitation to join the Grand Ole Opry in there. I wouldn't have the Hall of Fame thing in there. So where do you find a stopping place? And when they told me that I was going to be inducted in the Country Music Hall of Fame, I thought, this is a great place to pause. When they put the medallion around my neck that says that I'm a member of the Hall of Fame, that's where my book will stop, right in that area right there.
Wow.
Because I think it's a great place to stop it.
Now, there's still more coming up for this year. Charlie's 80th birthday, as we mentioned, on October 28th, but the 80th birthday volunteer jam will be on November 30th. And some of the people that will be on the bill will be Kid Rock, Chris Stapleton, Larry the Cable Guy, Travis Tritt. There's a lot more. You have played in this year alone 100 shows in 365 days. A very outstanding accomplishment for anyone, especially one who has seen so much of road and still, at 80 years old, going strong.
I love the road. You know, it's a lifestyle. This is a business like everything else. And I know a lot of young guys, when they come in, they get caught up in partying and, you know, wake up every morning with a hangover, and you can't operate like that. You know, this is not a party. This is a business. And if you're treated as one, you can stay around for a while. If you don't, then you're not going to. So basically, I have learned in my years, all the years I've put in, that you treat it like a business. You go to bed at night, you get up in the morning, you go do your work, you get your rest. There's a way to do things and a way not to do things, and I try to do it the right way.
The term show business is made up of two things, show and business. Unfortunately, for us that like to be on stage, the show part of it is about 15%, and the business part is about 85%. The only way you can sustain longevity is to know the business end of it. When's the biography coming out, Charlie?
12 to 15 months, I understand, preparation time to get it out once I get it finished. I hope to get it finished this calendar year.
Okay, that sounds good. Well, Charlie, congratulations on everything that you're coming up. Again, the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum will examine the life and career of Charlie Daniels. 80th birthday coming up. Of course, this great Journey Home Project annual dinner on September 13th. And a huge jam that's going to be coming up on November 30th with Charlie and Kid Rock, Chris Stapleton, Larry the Cable Guy, Travis Tritt, and more. Boy, Charlie, I'm tired of worn out just saying it, let alone having to do it like
wow.
You.
Wow, yeah, you made me wonder how I'm going to get all that done.
I'm beat. I'm going to go take a nap. Hey, Charlie, you are always welcome here. You have a home here. You know it.
Well, I appreciate that, and I'm sure we'll talk again as time goes on, my friend.
Thanks, Charlie. Good luck, and we look forward to having you back real soon, okay?
God bless.
When they wrote the word country gentleman, they intended it to be Charlie Daniels. One of the nice things about doing this show is you have an opportunity to meet people that you've watched from afar in a movie, maybe on television, listened to on the radio, danced to their songs. Well, in this particular case, our next guest is somebody I've known basically all my life. We grew up together in the same city in Pennsylvania. We were neighbors. Most recently, we reattached because of a new book that he has out. It's called Peace to You Too, Brother, A Story of Dreams, Devotion, and Devastation. During the turbulent times of the 60s and the Vietnam War, this is a subject that never goes away, and we're going to talk about a true story that he put into words. Joining us right now is author Chuck Porra. Hi, Chuck. How are you?
Hey, Ron. Good. Pleased to be on your show. Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate it. You've been coming to my concerts here now for the past year, and I really appreciate seeing a longtime friend sitting in the front row. So thank you for doing that, Chuck, and thank you for writing this book. This brings back a ton of memories from a turbulent time. It's like the movie The Big Chill. Remember that movie?
Oh, yeah. Yep. They all got together for one of their friends' funerals.
It is so entwined not only with the times, but with the music. You bring in so much of the music, which I know you're a big fan of. That's a very enticing part of this thing.
In that time period, music was a big part of every kid's life. You listen to it on the radio constantly. In Erie, we had WJET, which you know very well, Ronnie G. Kids just listen to the radio constantly. All the old songs from back then are now remembered today, and they bring back memories from that time every time you hear one of them.
I tell you, it would make a great movie. This is a true story based on a buddy of yours called upon to serve in Vietnam War. Why did you pick this character?
His story is most interesting. He did something back then that was considered taboo. He was drafted to go into the Army, and rather than to go, he chose to go to Canada. This was his way of not having to serve in the war. And it was something that he had strong convictions about. He was born and raised a devout Catholic, had feelings of peace and love for mankind, and no way was he going to participate in something that he felt was so wrong and so immoral. As a result, he, as a way of protesting, he went to Canada, was his way of avoiding being in the service and helping in his own certain way to bring about an end to this. And I felt that, you know, whether you agree with what he did or not, at the time, I really didn't. It's a story that deserves to be heard. and he wanted to have his story told, and I thought it was a great story, so we got together on it, and he filled me in on all the facts, and I wrote the book.
When he came back from Canada to the States, how was he viewed?
He never really did come back to the United States. He just came back for a quick visit. When President Carter was sworn in office, the very first thing that he did was to pardon the draft dodgers, because by that time, the war was generally accepted as having been wrong and immoral, which character, whose name in the book is Daniel, he felt all along that it was wrong. And so by then, by the time President Carter pardoned the draft dodgers, people accepted it. When he did come back here just for a brief visit, which was legal then to come back after years of the FBI trying to catch him, finally he was able to come back on his own. Some people scorned him, and others, you know, cheered him and called him a hero, because, you know, had it not been for people like him and all the protesters, you know, the war may never have ended when it did, and so many more thousands of Americans would have died. So, you know, there were mixed feelings at the time. Several people, like I said, scorned him. Several others thanked him for what he had done, believe it or not. And as time has gone on since then, more and more people have accepted that this was one wrong war. You know, what he did maybe wasn't so bad after all. It was what he felt he had to do, and he did it because of his convictions. The joint effort of him and all the others like him and all the protesters, like I said, brought the war to a much quicker close than it would have otherwise. Of course, there are still some people who hold it against him for what he did. But again, it's a story that deserves to be heard, whether you agree with it or not.
Have you received over the years, when you started to write this and ultimately published it, any criticism for glorifying what in those days we called a draft dodger?
Believe it or not, I have not. Any number of former service people have read it. You know, I'm always a little nervous when a former service person reads it, but I've never been criticized about it. So many of them have told me, you know, that, man, this is a good book, and, you know, we understand what he did, and, you know, we don't hold it against him, and, you know, we were over there against our will, and, you know, this war wasn't right, unlike World War II, which was a just war, and, you know, patriotism was sky high. In the Vietnam era, you know, it was just totally different, because we were fighting a war halfway around the country, and nobody really even understood what it was for or what our men were doing over there. Our men were over there, most of them against their will, and they didn't really understand what they were doing over there. And, you know, they were fighting a losing war against an enemy that did not wear uniforms. We didn't know who the enemy was, and it was on their home turf, which was a jungle, and our men were not really adequately equipped to be fighting jungle warfare. And so, you know, things were just so much different than they were in World War II, when all the veterans came home as heroes to ticker tape parades and all that, which was absolutely wonderful. But then the Vietnam vets came home, and a lot of them were scorned when they came home for having fought this war, because of incidents such as, like, the My Lai massacre and all the incidents of napalming and burning entire villages. And it was just such a different scenario as World War II. And it was really sad the veterans had to come home to such treatment. It was pathetic. I mean, they put their lives on the line. So many of them died, 58,000 to be exact. It was just such a pathetic seen that these servicemen, when they came back, were treated that way for having served. You know, that's the difference between the two wars and, you know, what was going on in Vietnam.
Chuck, I think it's important to note for our listeners that even though you wrote the book, and it is about, as we mentioned before, someone who tried to get out of serving our country, to a lot of people listening to us right now is blasphemy, you served in the military during the Vietnam War. So I want to make that clear, that you went in and you did your duty. I think that's important.
Well, yeah, you know, I did what I had to do, and I was not over in Vietnam, but I did serve. I was in the National Guard for 6 years, which I'm proud of. You know, I did my duty for my country and did my time, and, you know, I'm proud of it, even though it wasn't to the extent of what a lot of these young men back then had to do. The whole thing was that the military draft was such a key thing back then. It just hung over everybody's head like a storm cloud. You know, you never knew from one day to another if you were eligible for the draft, if you were going to get called. And as a result, you had to plan your whole life around it, where you really couldn't carry through with your plans. I mean, it just hung over your head. And it affected everybody one way or another, because everybody knew somebody who was facing the draft, or who had gone over to Vietnam, or who had been killed over there. You and I were just talking about how we knew a kid in our neighborhood who was killed. And it just hung over everybody's heads.
Yeah, it really did. There's no doubt about it. Well, it's a great book. I suggest it for a couple of different demographics, baby boomers and millennials. Baby boomers, because they lived through it. Millennials, because I'm a firm believer that if you don't know history, you can't handle the present or the future. And I think it's a great book that stresses the times and the chaotic times, as you express in the book, of the 1960s. By the way, I failed to mention that Chuck not only is a great author of books, he has several out right now. He's also had a massive career in the telephone business, and he has written well over 1,000 byline stories that he has written for the newspaper in Erie, Pennsylvania. He's done creative columns, movie reviews, and other periodicals and websites. And this book not only is in hardcover, but is in paperback, too. And tell everybody now where we can get it, Chuck.
Right. The title is Peace to You Too, Brother. Peace to You Too, Brother. If you're interested, you can check out my Facebook page, which is Chuck Pora, the Writer. That's P-O-R-A, Chuck Pora, the Writer. And on there, there's a link to my website where you can actually order the book, or you can order it through the publisher, which is www.lulu.com. That's www.lulu.com. And on there, do a search on my name, Chuck Pora, or else a search on the book, Peace to You Too, Brother. And so you can read about it. There's a preview on there where you can read the introduction and some of the first chapter, and you know, give you an idea what the book's about. So those are the two best ways, either through my Facebook page, which has a link to my website, or else through the publisher, www.lulu.com, by doing a search in my name or the title.
Chuck, I tell you something. I'm proud that you're from the old neighborhood. This is great stuff. It really is.
Nice of you to say that. I really appreciate it. And you lived through that era, and I think you could identify with a lot in it.
Oh, yeah. And I played a lot of those songs on that radio station you mentioned, too, at that same time. It's called Peace to You Too, Brother, A Story of Dreams, Devotion, Devastation of the Chaotic 60s, written by our guest, author Chuck Pora. And you check out the other books that he's written, too. Quite a guy, quite a talent. Charles, thank you for joining us, my friend.
Hey, thanks very much, Ron. I'll never forget old Ronnie G and WJET.
What he's referring to is my old radio name back in the, and I will say this sincerely, good old days. Thanks, Chuck.
Thanks very much, Ron. You take care.
You too, my friend. And I'm really proud of what he did. I didn't know there was so much talent in our neighborhood. And our next guest is one actor to be reckoned with. I mean, this man, whether it's on the big screen, on TV, or on Broadway, or off-Broadway, always does a beautiful performance. He's really a pro. And he's going to be part of Return of Law and Order. Pablo Schreiber joins us right now. Pablo, thanks for joining us, my friend.
Is that Ron Sedgy? Boy, your reputation precedes you, sir. You're too kind, Ron.
You are on TV with one of my favorite ladies. When you see Marishka, please tell her I said hello. She's a dear friend and a great guest of ours so many times. It had to be a delight working with her.
Yeah, well, I will tell her that, and I guess we share something in common then, because I'm a huge fan of hers as well.
Yeah, well, I tell you something. You do a remarkable job on being one scary individual. Do you know that? I mean, you're very convincing as a tough guy.
Thanks. Yeah, this character William Lewis is a real treat. He's not the guy you want to bring home to mom, that's for sure. He's been capable over the course of the last few episodes to commit some pretty heinous acts. The last time we saw him, he was taking Detective Benson on a 4-day rampage around the state of New York and Connecticut, I believe. And the last time we saw him, he was being wheeled out in an ambulance, unconscious, after she had brutally beaten him with a bedpost. This episode picks up, and it's going to be the trial episode, and he's going to end up representing himself, and he's going to try to turn the tables on her and put her on trial.
And in essence, this is the time that she really comes to realize that she's face-to-face with you, which is very intimidating to her character.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the character of Olivia Benson, obviously, has been on the air for 15 years now, and this is a real different side of her. For the first time, we see her as a victim. For the first time, we see her facing having to take her own advice. She's now in the place where she's been counseling victims for the last 15 years and telling them how to get through this trauma, and now she's the one having to deal with it. And so it's a whole new side of this character that we haven't seen. And after 15 years, to get to make your character into something completely different, I think she's been reinvigorated by it, and I just feel real happy and proud to get to be a part of that new and exciting dynamic.
Yeah, you bring up a good point. She's been preaching to other people of how she sustained this throughout the years and lived with it and what they should do, and now she's right back to where she was years ago as the character. Now, Pablo, how long did it take you to do that scene where the beating was going on? Because I got to tell you something, it was done very, very well, very convincing.
Yeah, the all the scenes that take place out in the Long Island, there's two or three of them, that take place out in the Long Island house that he takes her to. And, you know, I think we were shooting there for either 2 or 3 days.
Wow.
To get all of those scenes. And it was just a real, one of the more profound experiences I've ever had as an actor working with another actor. She really laid it out on the line, and the two of us, I think, established a connection that just allowed for, you know, we both felt comfortable working with one another, and once you establish that comfort level, the heavens are the ceiling in terms of what you can, places you can go.
Well, you know, you bring a lot to this show, because if I may, just for a moment, tell our audience of how many things you've done. I'm going to touch the tip of the iceberg, if I can. Of films like The Manchurian Candidate, Breaking Upwards, into Intro into the Fire, Invitation to Suicide, Happy Thank You More Please, on TV with the Muhammad Ali's Greatest Fight for HBO, The Good Wife, White Collar, and on Broadway and off-Broadway, Desire Under the Elms, Reasons to Be Pretty, which you won a Drama Desk Award for, Blood Orange, your professional debut, Julius Caesar. I mean, you bring a pretty long list of credentials to a show that's been up and running for a lot of seasons, and I don't feel like, you know, you probably went into that saying, hey, you know what, I'm a little intimidated with all this with a credential list like that.
No, I wasn't intimidated, certainly, but I wouldn't want you to miss The Wire and Weeds there, which were two of my major TV credits that the audience might know. So,
sure.
It's, you know, I have a little bit of history behind me, and certainly Mariska has a huge, huge history behind her. So we came to this process as equals and really eager to work with one another, I think, and it was a bountiful fruit that we picked together.
I also don't want to forget the classic Awake and Sing, too, which you had a nominated Tony Award for.
Yeah, that was a wonderful experience.
Bringing into the fact that you weren't, you know, intimidated with being on that set because of your experience. You know, I think a lot of times people will go into a project that has had a long running, like Law and Order. I mean, it's been around since, you know, Marconi was born. And to step into something and feel pretty relaxed, I think is a nice professional attitude to take. Because I've talked to some actors and said, boy, you know, I walked on that set, I was a nervous wreck because the thing's been around forever.
Well, you know, it was a real pleasure and a treat for me, mostly because, you know, that show, it has been around for 15 years. And there's a real formula to it, you know. It's a procedural drama, and it comes on each week, and we know what we're going to expect. And that's why people love the show, because they can tune in and they know what they're going to get. It's going to be wrapped up each week, you know. And this was an opportunity for me to be a part of the show, but to do something completely different with it. It was not a procedural episode. Any of the three episodes that I've done on there, none of them have felt like a normal Law & Order SVU episode. They're all completely outside of the normal world of that show. And so to get to breathe some new life into the show after 15 years, you know, especially for the character of Olivia Benson, to get to take her to the deeper and darker places that she hasn't been, it was such a wonderful opportunity to get to be a part of kind of breathing some new life into that show.
That show is almost done like a movie, though, isn't it, Pablo?
Well, the ones that I was involved with, I believe, certainly had more of that feel to it. Which, you know, again, we had Michael Slovis directing this most recent episode, and he's been involved with shows like Breaking Bad. And so to get to bring a bit more of a cable sensibility to that show and break it out of the procedural world was just a lot of fun.
You know, I got to tell you something. I mean this sincerely, okay? Talking to you, nice guy, and to see you as that character, it almost seems impossible because you are so convincing as somebody that is just haunting. And, you know, you're very good at what you do, Pablo, because, you know, a lot of people couldn't pull that off.
Well, it's a nice compliment. I work hard at what I do, but I got to give a lot of credit here to Warren Light and to Julie Martin, who wrote the episodes that I do. They, you know, they've made a real commitment along with Mariska to take this show to new places. And I can't say enough about that. After 15 years of being on the air, to be trying to make it fresh and to bring it to new places is just a real incredible thing to watch.
Well, you've done it, and you've done it successfully. And we'll be watching, too, this episode of Law & Order, where Pablo Schreiber, our guest, is the person who is abducted early on, Mariska Hargitay's character of Detective Benson, and now they meet in the courtroom. And Pablo's character is defending himself. Pablo, do me a favor. Come on back. You're a great guest.
Hey, thanks so much, Ron. It was a pleasure. I've heard a lot about you. It was great to talk to you.
Well, thank you so much. And tell Mariska we said hi again. And I hope you have a great 2016. But I hope you come back far before it ends, okay?
Will do. Blessings to you as well.
Okay, thanks, Pablo. Pablo Schreiber has been our guest. What a nice man and a talented guy, too. He's going to be on Law & Order. He plays a remarkable role. He truly does. Extremely convincing in his role of playing a bad guy, which you can tell by his demeanor. He's far from that. All across the USA and around the world, it's Ron Segi today. And we have a guest here that is just a real artist. And he's been known for wordplay. He's got a documentary film out right now that I'm anxious to talk about. Very important. And we're going to be talking to documentary filmmaker, our friend Patrick Creedon. Hi, Patrick. How are you?
Really good, Ron. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us on the show. And I meant what I said. This is a very important project. The name of the documentary is Going to Bed Hungry, The Changing Face of Child Hunger. Didn't realize that this affects 1 in 5 children in the United States?
It's hard to believe, isn't it?
Yeah, it's staggering.
It's, when we started researching the film and started meeting people, I almost couldn't believe that that was where the numbers are today. And yet what's happening is there's a, I would call it a new face of hunger in America. And and what I mean by that is hunger and food insecurity is reaching into communities and neighborhoods where it really never existed before. And it's happening for a lot of reasons. The economy and people who have health problems, people have sort of unexpected curveballs that life throws them. For whatever reason, there's a lot of families and especially a lot of kids who are struggling these days.
When you say they're in neighborhoods that you never expected, like what, Patrick? I mean, is it something that is middle-class America, upper-class America? I mean, we normally think of maybe an underprivileged neighborhood as being where the hunger is, but is that always the case?
It very much exists in middle-class America today. Just to illustrate that point, we shot the film primarily in a town called Palm Desert, California. My wife and I happened to get married in that town 14 years ago, and it's a beautiful town. It's kind of a resort community. It's 2 hours outside of Los Angeles, and yet all the families who are in our film live in Palm Desert. And what's really striking is that every parent that we interviewed who has used the food banks to support them and their kids, every single parent is working.
Wow.
They all have jobs. That's the part of this that made us stand up and sort of really take note of this. This is one of the families that we profiled. Their father had a heart attack when he was 47 years old, and he survived, but he was out of work for about 5 months.
Mm-hmm.
That was a big hit for them. Another family was a family whose father was an Iraq War vet, and he died unexpectedly this summer. He had some health challenges, and he passed away. Both families were dealing with problem that they never thought they'd face.
You know, I know that you have teamed up with Feeding America and Unilever Project Sunlight to have a program called Share a Meal, which I want to talk about. But before we get into that, I would be remiss if I didn't say this. And I don't mean to sound cruel about this, but this is what I think bothers Americans. We see a lot of television ads of the hunger overseas, and it's very, very effective. I mean, you got these beautiful young children who are looking in the camera. They got tears in their eyes. It's terrible. But shouldn't we kind of take care of the people in the United States of America before we start worrying about overseas? I mean, when you're talking about Palm Desert, California versus some third world country,
right,
and I'm not slighting that child in that third world country, but give me a break.
Of course.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And in fact, that's exactly why we wanted to tell the story and make the film, because I think the first step in addressing this problem is just telling people about it and showing it to them. There's one thing about the experience that I'll never forget. It was kind of a turning point for me as far as the work that I do as a documentary filmmaker. When we went out to find these families and to talk to them, I was expecting a sad story. I was expecting people that didn't want to talk about the situation they were in.
Sure.
I found exactly the opposite. I found a really joyful story. I found a really inspiring story about people who have hit a rough patch in their life and have turned to their neighbors or their friends or their community for help. And that's the kind of country we live in. You know, Ron, I think you're exactly right about it. I think that a lot of times people think of hunger as being a problem that exists really far away from our country, far away from our own neighborhoods. That's not the case, unfortunately. What I loved about telling this story with Unilever Project Sunlight and their team is that you see really a very joyous and a very inspiring story in communities that are helping each other. And the minute people find out that this problem exists in their own community, they can reach out. They can help the local food pantry. They can donate to the local food bank. They can have a food drive at their own school. They can have a block party and invite the whole community. Everyone brings a dish. I mean, there's so many different ways for people to get engaged in this challenge and to help people who are dealing with this. I think the very best way for people to do that is simply to go to the website, where there's a really cool thing called a Share a Meal Toolkit. The website is projectsunlight.us, and there's a lot of great ideas there as far as getting involved.
And I think this is a very effective short-run solution of the problem. But the problem that scares me is the long run, because you've got to keep educating the general public who can help in the Share a Meal program now so that they perpetuate over years and years and years unless we solve this problem. This is terrible, you know, Patrick. I mean, this is supposed to be the richest country in the world, and we're sitting here not feeding our young, our tomorrow.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny because these things sort of take time for people to find out about it, and
yeah,
for people to realize there's a problem that exists. I remember when Live Aid happened, like long time ago, back in the 80s,
right.
And that's when, for a lot of people, hunger in other parts of the world, sort of there was a face to it, and people realized there was a problem. I think what's happening in this moment is that people are realizing that there's a new face of hunger, and it's here in America. And it's not a sad face, and these are not helpless, hopeless people who are struggling with the problem. These are people in middle-class America who are finding it hard to provide just the bare necessities to their children and to themselves.
That's right.
And the more we start talking about it, the more we set aside sort of any shame or embarrassment about it, I think the sooner we can get to work to start solving this problem.
Where can we see the documentary, the video?
It's at projectsunlight.us. And if you go to that website, you can see the movie there. It's not real long. It's only about 5 minutes long. It's a short film.
Right.
But I dare you to watch it and not get swept up in it. It's a very emotional story. The honesty and the integrity of the families that we followed, the love they have for each other and for their kids, is really moving. And it's also, like I said, it also, you see that this problem has a solution, and the solution is in your listeners and our friends and in our own community, making a little bit of an effort, especially this time of year, to help people get through a tough time.
It's not the length of the film that makes the difference. It's the impact, and it does have an enormous impact. Going to Bed Hungry, the Changing Face of Child Hunger. In the United States, our guest has been famed documentary filmmaker Patrick Creedon. Patrick, I want to thank you, first of all, for the efforts that you did on this very, very important subject.
Thanks, Ron. It was really a pleasure for me to be on your show. Thank you.
Thanks, Patrick. Patrick Creedon has been our guest. As again mentioned, the documentary filmmaker, director of Going to Bed Hungry, the Changing Face of Child Hunger, right here in America. That's going to wrap things up for Ron Sedgy today. We hope you've enjoyed the past 2 hours. I want to thank you and all of our guests for being part of it. And our guests include Lee Greenwood, Al Roker, Glenn Beck, volleyball star Gabrielle Reese, Charlie Daniels, actor Pablo Schreiber, author Chuck Borah, and movie producer Patrick Creedon. Well, we will be looking for your cover to come next week, and we're going to do it again live all across the USA and around the world with Ron Sedgy today. Till then, I'm Ron Sedgy, hoping that you have blue skies and green lights.